I saw the bike rack.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection into session. Welcome, committee members, to our start on Senate bills. I'm sure we'll be scrutinizing these things with great detail. We're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 16A. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 16, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it allows the state treasurer to name a designee to serve in lieu of the treasurer on the Oregon 529 College Savings Board, and it directs the treasurer to designate a board chairperson, and it requires the board to report annually to the governor and the legislative assembly, and it allows that report to be included within the state treasurer's annual report. There's no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Thank you. And signed up, Michael Savaggio and Michael Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Savaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And it's a very simple bill, Senate Bill 16, so I'll be brief and then open it to questions for myself and Michael Parker. This bill came out of the Senate with no opposition on a 30-0 vote. It simply allows the state treasurer to appoint a designee to carry his wishes and votes into the 529 board meetings. The current structure is that the treasurer must appear on that board personally. The treasurer sits on numerous boards and commissions. There are only a scant few that require his actual personal appearance, and they are usually the very, very big ticket items, such as the land board and the Oregon Investment Council. This bill also allows for the chairmanship of the board to go to someone other than the treasurer or the treasurer's designee at the treasurer's discretion. It also increases the frequency of reporting that the board does to the legislature and the governor's office. Currently, that's a biennial report since the data is coming in annually, and we do make an annual report out of Treasury. We decided that it would make sense to just roll that into the usual annual report. So I'll stop and answer any questions that you guys may have. Respectfully.
Questions?
Get one.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, both Michaels, for bringing this to the committee. Michael Savaggio, I'm sure that the treasurer is still going to monitor and look after this program, because now this is a program that had some bad bumps. So I'm sure by doing this, the treasurer's not giving up his attention and oversight of this program.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Representative Wisnett, that's correct. The treasurer has indicated a desire to actually still remain on the board at this time, but the intent here is to allow for the treasurer to send a vote in if, for whatever reason, scheduling or otherwise, he's unable to make a personal appearance. So this adds some flexibility, but for the record, we do not intend that this should result in any kind of a lack of interest on the treasurer's part in the 529 program.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
So one question, one more question from me. I see that you're changing the report to an annual report instead of a biennial report. But I am kind of curious. You took out the February 1st date, and now there is no specific date by which you file this report. And from my perspective, from the legislature, I'd like to have this report ahead of time. And wondering why you took out that February 1st date.
Certainly, Chair Holby, members of the committee. The intent, as I mentioned, was to roll the report into the Treasury's annual report, which is put out third quarter of each year. It would have most of the same information with that we would put out ordinarily, but it would be about 3-4 months earlier than usual. Your offices were all sent prior to session the Treasurer's last annual report. From now on, that would contain the same information as we would put out for the College Savings Program.
And so I have a follow-up question, sort of the same question. So does that annual report filed by the Treasurer's Office have a statutory date specifically assigned to it that it shall be reported by?
Chair Holby, it has no statutory date. It has a deadline in the Treasury rules, which is that it comes out third quarter of each year. So we generally see that August, September.
And those rules are decided on by this Treasurer's Office?
That's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 16? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 48.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 48 limits the types of special districts within a metropolitan service district over which metropolitan service district has jurisdiction for boundary changes. There are no amendments before the committee, no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you. Senate Bill 48, we have Randy Tucker and Richard Benner signed up to testify. Looks like together. Good morning, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Lucas and Alice.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Benner. I work at Metro in the attorney's office. And to my left is Randy Tucker. I suspect you all know Randy. Senate Bill 48, as your committee administrator said, has to do with boundary changes to districts, special districts, service districts in the metropolitan region. Until 1997, the decisions were in the hands of a local government boundary commission. And in 1997, the legislature decided that didn't need a local government boundary commission where there was a metropolitan service district. And so the local government boundary commission was eliminated, and Metro succeeded to the boundary change authorities that the local government boundary commission had. And the list of service districts that were subject to this regulation found in several statutes was fairly long. Over the years, we've come to understand that some of those districts, their activities and programs are important for accomplishment of our mission, and some others are really not. And after talking to people from some of those districts and recognizing that they would prefer not to be subject to Metro jurisdiction. They must, for boundary changes, they must go to their local governments, cities or counties, to get approval. So this bill essentially recognizes the emerging reality and practicality of boundary changes. And what it would do is it would limit the number of service, the types of service districts over which Metro would have jurisdiction to those whose activities actually help us accomplish our mission. Let me just give you an example of the kinds of districts over today we are supposed to exercise jurisdiction but would not if this bill passed. Drainage districts, street lighting districts, diking, flood control, agricultural extension service, emergency medical service, law enforcement, human services, cemetery maintenance, animal control, vector control, geothermal heating, library and heritage districts. Currently, under today's law, Metro exercises jurisdiction over those districts, and if Senate Bill 48 passes, it no longer would. So if you're interested in the districts over which we would exercise jurisdiction, that's the amendment to the bill, and it's on the first page, and you see them in Section 1, Subsection 2. And essentially, it's water, parks, sewer, and metro, the service district itself. So that's the nature of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Randy could help me out.
Just one brief comment, Mr. Co-Chair, Holvey, Kolcher, Wisnant, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. The only thing I'd add is that the list of districts that's in the bill that we would maintain jurisdiction over was worked out with the Special Districts Association of Oregon when we first drafted the bill. And so that's the only thing I'd like to add. I don't think there's much more to say.
Questions from the committee? Not see anybody jumping up. I guess I'm just full of questions this morning. I want some clarity. Does this bill impact the Portland metro area only, or does it impact other districts around the state?
No, it's only it's in. You'll notice it's in ORS 268. That's metro's statute, so it's Portland metro only, our region only.
I guess one more thing to add is there's only one metropolitan service district in the state, and that's us. And by statute, the statute would have to change in order to create another one because it's limited to just the three counties of the Portland metropolitan area. And so we're the only one to which Chapter 268 applies.
That answers my question. So the statute is for Portland only?
Correct.
The 25 cities and three counties of the Portland.
Portland revised statutes, I guess. Okay. Having any other questions? Spark some real interest in this bill. I appreciate your testimony. And
I did promise short hearing, I believe. So.
Yes.
Let's talk about Urban Rural Reserve since we're here.
Different bill. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48. I'm okay to move this.
Don't you say you're going to wait on that?
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
I'm 48. I'm okay. Mr.
Yeah.
Chair?
Well, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 48.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 48A engrossed to the floor, but do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 48A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Tamara, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holvey?
Aye. Senate Bill 48, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 48. And we have a Portland Metro person here to carry this bill.
I ain't one.
Representative Sheehan, thank you very much.
I enjoy pulling the fangs out of Metro, so I'd be happy to carry that.
Thank you. Next up, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 53.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it directs the Department of Administrative Services Director to appoint members to the Charitable Fund Drive Committee to set policies and implement the program. It allows the committee to enter into a contract with the Charitable Fund Drive Management Organization to administer the program, and it deletes an obsolete statutory reference to the United Fund. There's no amendments before you, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. And we have Eric Grindy signed up to testify on this bill. Good morning. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Eric Grindy. I am here on behalf of Fred Lord, who's the chair of the Charitable Fund Drive Committee. This bill is essentially a technical adjustment bill whereby it removes language referencing the United Fund, which hasn't been in existence for about 15 years, and also provides a method to provide authority to the Charitable Fund Drive Committee to hire a Charitable Fund Drive Management Organization, which they have actually been doing. And I can ask or answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? So, I have to ask one question at least. Can you describe to me I guess it's sort of obvious that this program is to raise money for charities. And are there any specific charities that that this fund funds?
Co-Chair Holvey, I don't believe there are any specific, but there are approximately 900 charities that do receive some kind of benefit from this.
And it, I believe in your bill as well, it also, you mentioned that the fund can hire a manager. And what are the operating costs for this fund, I guess? How much of the fund actually goes to the charities as opposed to administrative costs?
Sure, Representative Holvey, Co-Chair Holvey, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This mentions a seven-person committee. Is this a new committee, or is this replacing one that's already in existence? Can you tell us how this is going to change the actual structure?
Co-Chair Sheehan, this does not change the actual structure. The committee has been a seven-person committee, and it will continue to be.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I lost my list. Mr. Slager.
Eric Grindy.
Eric Grindy. Good morning, sir. Thank you for your testimony. I'm familiar with this through other jobs and things. A state employee doesn't want to give his donation to the United Fund. Can he give to other alternatives? I know there's list and list. I know how you can proportion it and all that, but say he doesn't want to participate in this, so that, you know, there's no pressure or anything on that. It's all volunteer, I'm assuming, and he has, if he wants to give it to his church or something like that, is that correct? There's no, you know, I know we have fund drives and say we want 100% participation, things like that. Does that happen in the state of Oregon?
Co-Chair Wisnett, I believe that is absolutely correct, that they can either designate it to go to anywhere they want it to, or let the committee decide where it goes, if they just want to donate X number of dollars.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I think Chair Hovey also asked an interesting question. I think that we have great nonprofits and charitable organizations, but I'd like to know how much State of Oregon pays to run this. So if you could bring that back, I think that would be important.
Sure.
You know, hopefully it's, you know, a small percentage. You know, we get these reports from the Department of Justice of what percentage goes to overhead and what goes to the charity. So I'm sure that this is a small number, but I think it'd be good to put it on the record. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. And it would be, as Representative Wisnett, Co-Chair Wisnett pointed out, I would like to have a little more detail about the fund itself, as far as the, you know, the amount of administration and how much of the fund actually goes to the program functions, I think, of the charities that you give to. And I think that would suffice for us mostly. Is this fund held in the treasurer's office, or is it held in a bank that the committee and the director have access to?
Co-chair Holby, I don't know the answer to that, but we can find that out too. Since I'm pinch hitting for Fred Lord, I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to ask you all those questions. Just kind of interesting on the structure of the fund. Is it a trust fund, and you know how all that plays out? But yeah, if you could get some more specifics on that, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 53. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 109.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 109 repeals an obsolete statutory reference to the Interagency Shared Information System. There's no amendment, there's no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you. We'll see how this bill goes. And up first, we have Graham Slater. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and welcome.
Well, good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I'm the administrator of the Fund Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. So my division is the group that does things like the unemployment rate and the employment trends and the recession and all those things, but we also run a very small program that tries to figure out whether the people served by Oregon's workforce system actually find jobs or what kind of wages do they get after they're served. I'm here today not to talk about the data, but just kind of in my administrative role to ask you for your support for Senate Bill 109, which would actually repeal a statute, and as the summary says, a statute that governed a system of data that is now obsolete and that pretty much has been already destroyed with the legislature's previous blessing. So if I can just take 1 minute to step you through the history, I think you'll get the flow of this. Back in the early 1990s, Oregon was one of the first states to create a workforce-related performance measurement system called the Shared Information System, or SIS. It came into being with Senate Bill 81 in 1993. At the time, this was a very new kind of sharing, so the rules and the limitations were very tight of how the data could be shared. The Department of Justice was involved, and the workforce agencies were all very cautious because no one was really doing it at the time. But over the years, people became more comfortable with the data sharing, still with strict safeguards for confidentiality and privacy. So a new system that we call the Performance Reporting Information System, or PRISM, came into effect with Senate Bill 400 in 2001. By 2003, it was clear that PRISM would take over the role of the shared information system. It was more flexible. So Senate Bill 250 in 2003 formally made PRISM Oregon's workforce performance system and made it clear that once PRISM was fully operational, no new data were to be added to the shared information system. And in our testimony at that time, back in 2003, we said that Senate Bill 250 started the process of shutting down the shared information system. So fast forward to the current time, PRISM has taken its place as Oregon's workforce performance system. There's been no new data added to the shared information system since 2004. There's been no analysis requests for several years. And in fact, in 2009, we actually deleted all the data from the shared information system, really just kind of as an act of data security and confidentiality. So today we're just asking you to join with us in completing that destruction process, essentially, that started 8 years ago with the legislature's full involvement. ORS 657, 732, at this point is completely obsolete. So that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? So, just to be clear, several people have asked me, and I'm fairly certain of the answer to this, but question all the same. This doesn't have any impact on the work of the Interagency Compliance Network, which also shares information.
Chair Holvey, no, none at all. This is a completely standalone data performance program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
No other questions.
What about the interstate compliant insurance compact? Does that have any comment?
Representative Smith, do you wish to be recognized?
No, Mr. Chair. I don't deserve it.
So with that, no other questions, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 109. Would anybody like to... I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 109.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 109, or can I be recognized?
I move Representative Smith.
I move Senate Bill 109 be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Tamara, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Plum?
Yes.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisner?
Excused.
Vice Chair Holden?
Aye. Senate Bill 109, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 109. And I think maybe we'll put this on the consent calendar. Any objections to that? Seeing none, we'll put it on the consent calendar.
Just for kicks.
And
I was destroying something a minute ago.
I have a motion on the floor to suspend the rules to allow Representative Wisnett to vote on Senate Bill 109.
So moved.
Representative Clem moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Wisnett to vote on Senate Bill 109. So far we have a unanimous vote going, Representative.
I vote yay.
Representative Wisnett votes aye on Senate Bill 109.
I lost it yesterday.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 556. Jan, would you give us a brief description of Senate Bill 556?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 556, it requires DAS to adopt statewide policy for the implementation of schedule for reimbursement of mileage expenses of persons using their privately owned vehicle while conducting state business. Requires DAS to report findings on implementation of the tiered rate schedule to the Legislative Assembly. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards.
Good morning.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt. I'm the legislative policy aide to State Senator Chris Edwards. Senate Bill 556 came to you from our office and passed unanimously off the Senate floor. The bill was brought forth by our office for two reasons. One, to find a way to better incentivize the use of potentially idle state resources, and also a way to find ways to save money and be more fiscally responsible. What we found in looking at this is that currently DAS uses a flat system of mileage reimbursement rate for state employees. Even if a DAS vehicle or a fleet vehicle was available and a public employee chooses to take their personal vehicle, they are reimbursed a flat 51 cents per mile. In speaking with DAS and looking at the system, we realized that actually the federal system is tiered and would allow for a cost savings potentially if we implement the tiered system. What the bill proposes is that through administrative rule, DAS would go ahead and adopt the federal GSA tiered system rate. So instead of being reimbursed a flat 51 cents per mile, if they choose to take their personal vehicle as opposed to a fleet vehicle, they would be reimbursed the lower 19 cents per mile that currently stands. What we've seen is that since July 2009 through December 2010, the state of Oregon has spent $8.4 million on mileage reimbursements. The fiscal analysis of the bill is indeterminate. We're not quite sure exactly how many times a state employee chose to drive their personal vehicle versus a DAS fleet vehicle, but we're hoping that with this bill and implementing the tiered system that we could see some substantial savings in mileage. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Questions from the committee? Sir?
Go ahead.
Representative Clem.
Oh, thank you. So what was the testimony like on the Senate side about why people, you know, obviously the savings would come from my constituents' pockets since they're all state employees. What is the reason exactly, what was provided as any counterpoints? Like, why do people use their own personal vehicles instead of the other?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Clem, there was actually no testimony in opposition to the bill, and there was not actually a perspective given from any state employees or public employee unions. The only people that testified on the Senate side were our office and representatives from DAS.
Other questions?
I still thought that was a good question. Do we know? So I recognize there wasn't any testimony opposed. As we're thinking about it, we thought about any potential impacts on what this and how we need to be rethinking our fleet, for instance. I mean, if eventually we're using their own vehicle, then, you know, makes less sense to own vehicles, you know, in the state motor pool or whatever, and maybe that's the point and sort of the back door way of getting there. Maybe that's a good thing. On the other hand, if we still have some vehicles and some people are using their own, but we just, the ones we have are getting used less, I recognize it's for them to implement a plan. But have we thought about what impact it might have on the state fleet, et cetera?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's Representative Smith. We actually have spoken with the individual who manages the DAS fleet, and he has assured us that they do have enough vehicles to go ahead and continue at current service levels and actually see a potential increase. We do know that the DAS fleet actually does. There are more state employees that choose to use the DAS fleet than currently use their personal vehicles. We just don't know. There's no way currently of tracking when the option to use your state vehicle, like when they choose to use your personal vehicle versus a state vehicle. But we do know that there are more miles put on a DAS fleet vehicle than on personal miles during a given fiscal year. I have those numbers, and I'd be happy to send them to your office as well. What we were looking at is, you know, a lot of our fleet vehicles might sit idle at an agency, and there might be instances where it might be advantageous for a state employee to take their personal vehicle versus a state vehicle. However, if we have the fleet vehicle, if we're paying the state to maintain and do the maintenance on that fleet vehicle, the argument could be made that we should incentivize the use of those fleet vehicles, which are actually cheaper for us to maintain and insure than it is for us to reimburse at a flat 51 cents per mile if an employee chooses to take their personal vehicle as opposed to driving one that was provided for them by the state.
Thank you. I think maybe I'd like to have Mr. Krieg come up and Brian King. Take a little pressure off of Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
For the record, I'm Brian King. I am the Department of Administrative Services Fleet Manager. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions on this.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Smith?
Yeah. So I'm wanting to make sure I understand the intent of the bill. I mean, it seems great, but, you know, I want to make sure I understand the intent of the bill. And if it is to increase the use of personal vehicles or decrease or merely make it smarter, right? Merely sort of make it so that we're using them more intentionally. And that may be a question better asked of the bill sponsor or of you, but and then I want to understand that intent as best I possibly can and then try to link that intent as best I possibly can to our best hunch about how it'll actually play out. So offer whatever comments you choose.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith. Actually, this is part of a more comprehensive goal of fleet to actually, yes, use vehicle transportation smarter. It is a big cost across the state. We do quite a bit of driving in order to conduct business as people are traveling around the state to deliver services. So it is just another tool to reduce the cost of what's going on. If, as was mentioned, if people are choosing to use their car, and there can be various reasons why that might be, instead of a state vehicle, it could reduce the number of vehicles we need, and that is also a good cost reduction. And it does come back around to the smarter use of those resources and the money it takes to do that type of business.
So if I could follow up. So is it our impression that by
implementing a tiered rate schedule for the reimbursement of state agencies of mileage expenses of personal and privately owned motor vehicles. That will decrease or increase the use of those personally privately owned vehicles.
And again, we don't know. It is a possibility that it'll pretty much stay the same and it'll just cost less. Mm-hmm. We won't know for probably a good year into it. We track how much is spent on private mileage reimbursement. I know how much miles are traveled, of course, in the DAS vehicles. But how that's going to mix together is an unknown at this point. That's why it's indeterminate.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah, thank you, and Senator Edwards for bringing this bill and trying to save us money. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
I have several little questions. Sarah, you and the good senator didn't look at going the next step to see if we should authorize rental cars for savings.
Mr. Co-Chair, we did not go that far. Originally, when we were looking at the bill, Senator Edwards wanted to do a more complicated system that would take into consideration what type of car you were driving, so that employees who drove, say, a Hummer would receive less mileage reimbursement than people who drove, say, a compact sedan. However, in speaking with DAS, we realized that that system would be a little too hard to implement and that the federal GSA rate actually complies with IRS and other tax codes, and it would be simpler for the state to go ahead and implement this. And I think what Brian said is, you know, we don't know exactly what this will look like over the next year, but if there is significant savings that could be achieved through this process or through incentivizing the use of rental cars, I think that's something that the legislature could address once we have a better understanding of what type of vehicles employees are driving at what point in time.
I think, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I think, you know, we've opened a good thing that we can investigate. I'm not sure how much we can get, and I'm okay with the bill. But I think that we need to also look at, are we better to pay the 51 cents a mile, or are we better to have a motor pool? And I know from experience working with nonprofits that if they're doing a lot of traveling, it's cheaper for them to rent a car than to pay the miles. I know that for a fact, because they're looking at their budget. They do that. There's a question here. The federal rate changes. We're looking for $5 a gallon of gas. That rate's going to go up. So the bill's written. I haven't read it in detail, but it's written so that rate that's not established 51 cents. That rate is determined by what the federal government establishes. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, I represent Wisnant. That is correct. The bill basically just asked DAS to establish, through rule, the federal GSA rate. So we're not specifically calling out numbers for reimbursement, which allows them to be flexible in their administrative rulemaking. The GSA rate is updated, I believe, at the first of every year. I'm not sure if it's linked to the fiscal year or the first of every year.
I think it can be updated more than that. But the last question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think, or it's a statement, I think, this is a guess, that people choose to use their own vehicle when they maybe have a passenger, or they're probably combining personal business with the official business. But I think that's why this bill is not a bad idea. So, thank you.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Federal mileage reimbursement rate, it's my understanding that it's based on an estimate of what it costs per mile to drive the average car. So the assumption in this bill is that we can actually provide state-owned cars through the motor pool at a much lower rate. So obviously we're trying to drive people away from using their own vehicles and towards using state-owned vehicles. Which I could understand if we either believe that the reimbursement rate's too high, so people are actually making more money than they're causing wear and tear on their car and using in gas, or if we have evidence that we can actually provide those cars from the state motor pool at a cheaper price. So has DAS, do you actually have, can you demonstrate that the cost of the motor pool is less than if we just entirely went to, for example, a reimbursement model?
co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Conger. Yes, actually, we do track that, and I can provide that for you if you'd like. Right now, if I remember correctly, biennium to date, the cost of managing the fleet per mile versus the 51 cents is about $1.8 million less than if we just reimburse people private miles. That you also have to take into account some situations. I don't know about you, but personally, I'm not going to be loading five inmates into my minivan and driving them to the work site. So there are many of these situations where it's not going to be possible to reimburse. We also have tools online where agencies can plug in how many miles they're doing, how many days they're going, so they can see if a rental car is less, a state motor pool car is less, reimbursing miles is less, or any of the rental agencies we have on contract are less to use a vehicle. So we have those tools. The state policy directs state agencies to find the most least cost-effective, or the most cost-effective, sorry, method of transportation. So we do provide those tools, and we do monitor very closely.
Okay, so we're not really comparing apples to apples in the sense that obviously there are certain vehicles that have to be state-owned, like patrol cars and prison transportation and other things, snow plows. Presumably nobody has one in their driveway except for Representative Klein. But on the, I mean, have you drilled down to the point where you're looking at typical passenger cars, four-door sedans that someone would use to take a trip, 100 miles to go someplace and then inspect something or go and make an office visit for an agency or something like that? Because I think that's really what we're dealing with here with this bill, is we're trying to, again, if I'm stating it correctly, we're trying to drive people to use state-owned vehicles because we think it's cheaper. And I'm just asking if we actually have compared, take out the prison vans. Have you done that?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Conger. We haven't drilled down quite that far. That is somewhere we're going, where we're providing to the top 10 agency customers the underutilized vehicles and how much it costs them per mile. So, yes, you're absolutely right. When we get down to that level, it is less expensive. How much expensive? I'll find out. I'll get that to you within a day. It only take me about a day to do that. We can cull those vehicles out and find out what their maintenance costs, what their fuel costs, and what the cost of ownership is, and get that. My feeling is, yes, it is a bit less because, as you mentioned, those other types of vehicles are usually less or more expensive to operate. So it is that, especially when we're looking at a sedan that is assigned to an agency, we do want them to use it rather than have it sit there. Or if they don't need it, let's get rid of it. And that is what we want. It's a smart way to do business.
Right. One more follow-up, just a comment. I appreciate that, and I think I heard you say that your analysis would look at the cost of ownership as well as maintenance and operation, so gas, maintenance, cost of owning the vehicle in the first place. So I appreciate that because I think that's, obviously, we need to know the full cost. But the last thing you said was we want them to use it if it's just sitting there, and I think that's true if we can demonstrate that we're saving the state money by owning the vehicle in the first place. But if they're not using it, I don't think we want to force them to use it so that it then becomes self-justified. Thank you.
Representative Matthews, a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I'm supportive of the bill. I signed on to it early, and thanks for bringing it. Representative Wall, I do have a question about DAS specifically. Regarding some of the cars, you must have assigned to people, I would imagine, because there's some positions out there that require a response in the middle of the night. I see several on the freeway coming in from Gresham, and I imagine those are employees that have assigned vehicles. Is there ever a time that somebody that had an assigned vehicle would drive their personal vehicle instead? And then further than that, do you allow in DAS for people to transport their personal children or their spouse? Are they covered if they're driving a DAS vehicle? With, say, their child to drop off at school and whatnot. I'm just trying to figure out some of the reasons why we experienced this in the city of Gresham. Some of our deputy fire marshals didn't feel that they could transport their child to school, so they were driving their personal cars. They weren't submitting for reimbursement, but it was a barrier to them using city-supplied vehicle. Can you answer that or speak to that?
co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Matthews. No, we don't allow, especially minors, in the vehicle. There are situations within rule where it's allowed. If you have a medical condition, you need a spouse or another medical aide to go with you. Those types of situations are allowed. We had a recent question come up about an employee who wanted to take their baby for breastfeeding, and that was, no, we're not going to take that risk as an employer to have you take your infant in the car with you. So that is some of the situations where people might be using their personal vehicle. I've done things like that when I've gone on trips. If I was going to take a longer weekend with my family, then it makes sense for me to take my own vehicle in order to get that family time. Most of the time, it's going to be somewhat of a convenience. If they're going to be quicker to go from their home, they might go from there. Although we would allow them to take a state car home in that situation, too, if it's closer from their personal residence to this work site that they're going to go to.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Would they be able to stop at the grocery store on the way home? Co-Chair Ho, if it is within a break period, their break time is their break.
No, say if the car is assigned to them and they drive it home and keep it overnight.
No, we would.
They can't stop at the grocery store on the way home?
No, it's not their car. It's for state business only. Their work site. If they're allowed to take a car home, that's basically they're leaving from their work site. And when they're using that car, going to or from it, it is for state business.
Thank you. And I have Representative Cameron.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So we're going to force them to drive all the way home, get in their personal vehicle, and drive all the way back to the grocery store?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Holy, like. Representative Cameron. Unless we want to change the rules, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I have one other question that this bill, the tiered system is something that's established already by the federal government, essentially the GSA, and so we're just using that same tiered system as they publish it, I suppose, periodically. The follow-up part of that question is so we only would pay currently the 51 cents or the full rate when there was no government-owned vehicle available. So what is the definition of available? Say I live in Creswell, Oregon, and I need a state car, but there isn't one there, and my work site isn't here in Salem where the motor pool is, but it's in Roseburg. So is a state car available to me?
Chair Holy, no. In that case, it would be that there is not one available. And it is a determination for a business reason. If you're driving 2,000 miles a month, we would want that agency to contact us because it would be less expensive for us to give you a sedan than pay you $1,000 a month in reimbursement. So those are the types of business decisions that give a little bit of flexibility. But, no, we wouldn't say that there's a vehicle available to you in that case.
So how far away do I have to live from the motor pool before it's not available?
Chair Holy, it depends on where your work site is. If your work site...
Okay, how far away is my work site from the motor pool before it's not available?
Chair Holy, I can't answer. It depends on the agency and where that agency assigns you as your work site. If your work site, we have people that commute from Portland to Salem, and if their job is in Salem, or if their job is in Detroit from Salem, we're not going to give them a state car to drive from Portland to Detroit. The work site distance is from Salem to Detroit. So I don't know how to answer that question.
So I guess what I'm saying is that if your work site or if your office is in Salem or you come to Salem, then the motor pool's in Salem and your work site somewhere else, then that state car is available to you. But if you don't come to work on a regular basis, there's many state agency offices around the state where there are no motor pools. And so if they had to go out on a visit, then they wouldn't. A state car would not be available to them unless it had been assigned.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Hey, we're not trying to beat this down, but I think you made a good point. I think what your comment was that someone's looking at what we're reimbursing that person for his job, and if it hits a magic number, you know, $1,000 a month, then we might want to, or $2,000, then we may want to cheaper to give him a state vehicle. My question to you, is that correct? And is who looks at that, or what triggers that? Is it an automatic trigger? It kicks it out and say, wait a minute, we're paying this guy too much mileage, or who's overseeing that?
Coach Wisnett, members of the committee, that is part of what we do for minimum mileage calculation every year. What we're doing is taking into account the operational costs, the cost of insuring the vehicles, all those pieces that it takes to run the vehicles, and looking at what that mileage point is. Currently, it's about 600 miles a month for that cutoff, and where it's better to reimburse people or not. And that is something we monitor every year,
but
based on the changing.
Follow-up, so just, but you'd want to maybe do it every 6 months and say, you know, let's make a management decision, because you're saying you only look at it once a year when you're reauthorizing it, so it might be. Thank you.
I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I'm not seeing any other questions. I think we will wait until we get some feedback to some questions that we asked. Is that, have we got some outstanding questions still? Outstanding information?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Matthews.
It sounds to me like there's two issues here. One is the bill itself, which is I think a good solid bill, and I think we can move it. I think there's a series of questions that probably don't necessarily directly relate to the bill that could relate to efficiency, and also, pardon the expression, but common sense. I think personally that if we want to incentivize people to use these vehicles, we should probably look at some changes in the program and allow somebody to maybe stop at the store on the way home. I mean, with all the talk about reducing greenhouse gas, and I hear a lot of it because of my electric car. I just think there's a couple of issues beyond the bill. I don't necessarily think those questions are going to change anything about this bill, but I think we need to discuss that for the future, maybe how we can talk about how to incentivize that further. So I would like to see us not delay, because we have a stack of work to do this session. That's my opinion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your opinion. Representative Clem.
Just one more time, I want to make sure, because I think this is going to be a clear disincentive using your own vehicle. 32 cents a mile on every single mile difference. And the person, I'm pretty sure you said this, the person at Motor Pool said, we have enough capacity to get all these new miles in, and we have that many extra Motor Pool cars currently that all the people who decide they'd rather take 19 than 51 can use them. We don't have to buy one new car for this.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Clem. It's not necessarily that we don't have all the extra cars or money to buy the vehicles. We do have some situations where we've been pushing to better utilize the vehicles to get as high above that 600-mile mark as possible for the vehicles that the state has invested in. So there is some capacity to use the existing vehicles that we have right now. As we look at, is there going to be more demand on those vehicles? With what's going on in government now, there may be some downsizing and more vehicles available. So that's something that's going to play out over the next year and a half for us to know for sure if we're going to need more vehicles. But our first take at it is that, no, we do have enough vehicles to move around within the enterprise across it to take care of any initial increase in that change.
Any other?
Mr. Chairman, to be honest, I'm kind of surprised by that. I mean, this is a major disincentive. Every single mile, a reduction of, you know, almost more than half. I'm a little surprised that we have that capacity, because I just think of all the people who would not want to pay that extra. It's a hassle. Obviously, you can't. You know, I'm not. You guys are a little tough over there on the shopping and all that stuff. But people get really mad when they see state motor pool vehicles doing anything, you know, other than being driven by some sort of, automaton who's, I'm going to work. If they have any kind of life whatsoever as a state employee, we don't like them. So I think that I can't believe it's not going to make a bunch of people go use the motor pool, which is the intent of the bill. And I guess I don't know the data. I just can't believe there's not going to be a lot more people, and we're going to have to buy more cars. And if the end that works out to be more financially responsible, even to buy more cars, then I guess it does. I just thought I heard that we wouldn't need any new cars, which I think you just said again. And I have a hard time believing that. Maybe I'm just naive, though.
think we'll leave it at that. And I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. It has spurred a little bit of conversation, probably more than most wanted to know about reimbursement rates for driving state-owned vehicles or their private vehicles. So I don't think we're going, I know we have a pretty large workload, but we're not going to move this bill today. And we will revisit it. It looks like an extremely good bill, so I'm sure we will bring it up again. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556. And I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 13.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Concurrent Resolution 13 honors the Eugene Water and Electric Board for 100 years of utility service.
Thank you. Fairly simple concept. Up we have Jason Huser. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holvey. Good morning, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having us here, meet us here this morning. For the record, I am Jason Huser, Government Relations Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and I'm going to be very brief. We just want to say thank you for considering us for this great honor. And just real quickly, I want to say it's been a great 100 years for UWEB. We've got a lot of accomplishments to look back upon fondly in this centennial year. Three big accomplishments of the last century are diversifying our portfolio, making early and successful investments in conservation and renewable energy, and we've already got our eye on the next 100 years. Looking at those challenges, addressing increasing electric demand due to electric vehicles, and additionally trying to find a second source of drinking water and protecting the one we have, the McKenzie River, for now, something that's very near and dear to Co-Chair Holvey's heart. And I'll conclude my remarks there, and if there's any burning trivia questions about EWEB, I'll try to tackle them.
Questions, Representative Smith.
How has EWEB tackled your local motor pool? Have you guys used local and personally owned vehicles, or do you use state motor pool vehicles?
Oh my goodness, I'm going to pass on that one. Right. And let the folks from DAS come up with answers
and questions.
See how we measure up.
The topic.
Representative Clem.
Yes. Did you use the shared information system?
Another pass.
Okay.
Representative Clem.
You have an annual charitable fund drive for administrative costs.
We do have a charitable fund drive, and I'm proud to say I've been participating every year I've been at UWEB, and I don't know how much it costs.
Well, I, on a serious note, I do want to recognize the good work that EWEB's done over the years in providing water, not just to Eugene, but regionally. I think the water source of drinking water is extremely, extremely important to our economy and enabling our communities to grow. Without good water, we can't grow. And as well, I commend the forward-thinking board down there for looking at renewables as well and providing great service. My power doesn't go off very often. And when it does, there's usually a good explanation.
I see you didn't pay your bill.
No, actually, the last explanation was that a squirrel got into the substation and it blew up.
It would survive.
I couldn't believe it. It was so with that, seeing no other conversation about EWEB, before it goes any further, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 13. And open a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 13.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16A and gross to the floor.
What? Senate the adopted.
SCR.
Wrong page.
Second.
Representative Wisnett, a new motion.
Wrong page. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 13 be adopted.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 13 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Tamara, shall we have a vote, please?
Representative
Campbell?
No.
Sorry. Yes.
Representative Collier.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Yes.
Vice Chair Wizard.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Holden. Aye. Senate concurrent resolution having received required votes is moved to the floor. And I'll close the work session on SCR 13.
Thank you, Carrie.
And I will carry that bill.
And Cameron, get Cameron.
So, any other business of the committee?
Apparently, doesn't like the ducks.
Seeing none, I will close the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
That's it.